Case number 06-3166, United States of America versus Anthony Rice, appellant. Ms. Wicks for the appellant, Mr. Smith for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Jennifer Wicks on behalf of Mr. Rice, and I'll be attempting to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. I'd first like to start with, both of Mr. Rice's contentions that his speedy trial rights were violated under the Speedy Trial Act and under the Sixth Amendment. And starting with the Speedy Trial Act, going through, I think there's two important periods of time where simply the record below is insufficient to support that time should be excluded under the Speedy Trial Act. The first is the first period of time from the government's motion that it filed with the unsealing of the indictment in November of 2003, the court's determination to essentially stay and exclude time under the Speedy Trial Act for 270 days is void under the Supreme Court's ruling in Zedner. And the reason is because the district court solely considered basically the government's tactical and administrative interests and failed to consider and didn't make any findings relevant to the interests of the public and the defendants.
Well, the district court didn't use the phrase public interest, but is there any question when you look at the transcript that that was certainly in mind?
Well, I think given the way that the government presented what needed to happen in the case, the court didn't even fully have sufficient information to determine if it was.
Well, what would be an example of the public interest that the district court should have considered?
I mean, the public interest in having the case resolved. I mean, the factor that the court must consider is the public and the defendant's interest in having a speedy trial, and given what the government raised as
What I'm getting is if the court says okay, I'm going to address the public's interest in a speedy trial, what would be the sorts of things the court would look to?
I think it's balancing that interest. I think
what is that interest? Or are you just saying all the court needs to do is invoke the words public interest and that's
sufficient?
If it's not just invoking the words public interest, what are some of the factors the district court would need to look to when balancing the public interest?
I think the public interest is to have a speedy trial, similar to the defendants, although clearly the defendants have other rights, such as effective assistance of counsel. And essentially what the government is saying is there's so much material that the defendants need more time to deal with it. And the problem with all of that is it's linked into the wiretap issue. And the wiretaps in this case, 1-2% were in English. So for Mr. Rice, a local defendant, I think all of the interests are lined up with having a speedy trial. But the government, except for the government, which interest is apparently in getting all of these wiretaps or supposedly getting all of these wiretaps translated and presented to the defendants, when in fact only 1-2% had anything to do with Mr. Rice's case. So I think, I mean, I'm trying to answer the court's question, but I think the problem here in this record is I don't think the court takes that into consideration. The court looks at two things essentially that all come from the government, and at that point, the government doesn't present the full picture.
Rice did not object at the time, right? Didn't object to the continuance at the time, right?
I think under Zedner, a defendant can't waive that time because it's.
When was the first time at which Rice objected to the timing?
I agree that I think on or about December 1st or 2nd, his first lawyer filed a pleading saying that he didn't object. But then there was a subsequent bond review motion. And then it's in June when the court, effectively the court severs the foreign defendants from the local defendants. Well,
when did the actual severance take place? Not till August,
It was formally ordered on August 13th. but discussed and essentially conceded by the government in June, and there was a subsequent status hearings before.
Do you have any cases that you can cite to that say that that type of colloquy, the informal severance, has the legal consequences you're claiming now? I mean, formal severance, to be certain, is a factor that can be considered, but how about this notion that there's some informal severance or an effective severance? Do you know any cases like that?
I guess I'm saying informal in the sense that it wasn't memorialized in the order, but it was an issue that was raised, and the government conceded that they would be separate.
Where courts have relied on that?
I think for the same reasons this court should look at that, where the government at that point was conceding that the local defendants were basically insulated from the international defendants, and that it, clearly it would make sense to have separate trials. I mean, that was discussed and it was essentially a resolved issue, I think, if you
now
look at the record.
When, I know you said, but I want to make sure I have it fixed right in my mind. When did that occur?
The first discussion of that was on June 7th in 2004. And at that point, there's only four or five local defendants left.
When then did the formal severance?
There's a formal order on August 13th. And that's
2004. When did the trial finally occur?
January 2006.
So there's still over a year between the August.
Yes.
What went on during that period of time?
There's a period of time from September, court's indulgence. There's a period of time from September 23rd to October 8th, where I think if you look at the docket, there actually aren't any pending motions and then you have the very long period of time between June 28th and January 4th. There were pretrial motions heard. The first trial date was supposed to be January of 2005, and that was continued because of Mr. Bailey's need for new counsel. And motions were scheduled for May, with trial to start right after that. For scheduling reasons, that was then continued to June 27th. And sort of the technical placeholder that the court discussed was a motion to suppress that had been filed in March. And that was to be essentially the placeholder, according to the court, under the Speedy Trial Act. And I think the problem with that is if you look at the local rules the Senate discussion of the Speedy Trial Act talk about, the local rules essentially a remedy for if a trial court can't get to a case soon enough. And I think waiting almost 7 months between the motions, there's motions that are held in May, and then it's continued for trial and one more motion in June, and then we hold that, essentially have that as the placeholder to set the case all the way in January.
What's the remedy to which you referred? Drawn from the local rules, what is the remedy to which you referred?
The remedy is for the case to be transferred to another court. For the two local defendants that went to trial, that was a 27-day trial. It was not, compared to other trials, I think it was not an unreasonable thing to think you could fit in at some point between June and January. And clearly, the government had a preference for how it wanted to present the evidence at trial, but the defendants were set and ready to go to trial at the end of June, and there was sufficient time for the case to be heard before jury, before there was any other scheduling problems for counsel. If the court doesn't have any other questions, I'd like to reserve my remaining time. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Peter Smith on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, this was a complex drug trafficking case, and it proceeded apace, and there was no...
When was the defendant here arrested?
I'm sorry?
What date was the defendant arrested?
It was November 12th, 2003.
When did he go to trial?
January 4th, 2006.
That's proceeding apace?
It is relative to this court's cases. For example, in Lopez Sierra, that case was a very similar case. It was a complex drug trafficking case. In this case, there were 19 co-defendants. Lopez Sierra was very similar. Lopez Sierra took more than 3 years to get to trial. Yeah,
that doesn't make it proceeding apace, does it, counsel?
Well, with respect to this, let's put it this way. There was no Speedy Trial Act violation.
Don't try to overstate your case.
I agree with you, Your Honor. There was no...
And by June 2004, there's a pretty good sense that this was going to be severed, right? I mean, that you had the international and the U.S. defendants, right? So why the delay from June 2004? You're down to a limited number of defendants. It's not as complex. There's no question at the time of the December continuance. This was a complex matter. But by June, things had clarified substantially.
Well, I don't think there's any authority for the proposition that the court can accept a proposed severance as being a severance for purposes of the Speedy Trial Act. But even if the court did accept that date, June 7th, 2004, and many of the defendants objected to severance because for a variety of reasons, they wanted additional discovery or they were in the latter group and they objected to that.
But at that time, don't you agree, it was pretty clear that this was headed towards severance of some nature.
It was.
And that Rice was going to be in, we knew which group Rice was going to be in. He did not object to the severance, right?
He did not.
Okay, so.
Rice did not. That's right. So I guess let's look at it this way. There was no Speedy Trial Act violation because on the day of appellant's arraignment, and that was also the day that most of the other local defendants appeared before the court, the government filed a motion for a continuance. Now, we think that motion for a continuance was properly granted. But even if the court ignored that, the last co-defendant to appear before the court appeared in August 2004. But even if the court looked at the June 2004 date, which is what you're suggesting now, there was no Speedy Trial Act violation because prior to that date, there were motions, and there also weren't all of the co-defendants before the court. So even appellant agrees that prior to that time, there was no Speedy Trial Act violation. So after June 7th, 2004, you have about a 3-month period until October 14th, 2004, when the co-defendants file their motions to suppress under the then existing schedule in the case. And
when was that filed? Because it's not clear when Rice joined that, right?
He did. It is clear.
Yeah, from the record, what's the earliest date we can assign to Rice joining the motion to suppress the wiretap evidence? I couldn't figure it out.
The answer is it's not entirely clear from the transcript. The court makes a reference to all of the defendants having joined the other wiretap motions later. And there's no dispute that Rice is considered to have filed that motion, and that motion is pending until the start of trial. So I guess what I was trying to say is that even if you look at the June 7th date, you only have about 50 days that aren't excluded for...
But if you can help me, and this just, I don't know this. This isn't a trick question or anything. When was that, the motion that was eventually heard on January 4th, the motion to suppress that was heard on January 4th, 2006, when was that filed?
It was filed on October 14th, 2004.
2004. And
right.
But we're not certain when Rice joined it. We just know that at some time he did.
Yes, because the court speaks sort of after the fact, but I can give you a more precise answer.
Isn't that your strongest argument? Isn't your strongest argument that a 270-day continuance was granted in December? That gets you to September, and then the next argument is that this motion to suppress of which Rice is a part?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And I mean,
maybe on reply, your opponent can take up those two issues, because to me, you do the math on those, it's done, right?
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, so there's a variety of different ways the government would prevail and there would be no Speedy Trial Act violation. One would be a 270-day continuance, and we've made an argument about when that runs, but even saying it runs from the granting of it in December 2003, it would go until September. You'd only have about 30 days until the defendants...
And you've got the motion to suppress, and you're up to trial.
Correct.
But I thought that I understood you to say that even if you take away that 270-day continuance, it's still not a violation.
Correct, because you have the last remaining co-defendant, Narcisco Liriano, appearing before the court for the first time in August 2004, and you have about a two-month period there.
But isn't that colored by this severance issue, and doesn't that just get too complicated?
If they never called him, he had to stay there forever?
I'm sorry?
If they never caught the other guys, he had to stay in jail forever awaiting trial? Is that your position?
Give us the simplest.
Simple
works better, at least for me.
I mean, I guess the simplest is the court properly granted the 270-day continuance. The reasons that the court gave, and they're detailed on pages 5 and 6 of the government's brief, are fairly expansive. The court talks about the case being complex, about foreign defendants, about the need to obtain evidence from foreign countries. That is all very similar to Lopez Sierra, where this court affirmed and found those findings sufficient. As Judge Griffith, as you suggested earlier today, the fact that the court was cognizant of the relevant factors in Lopez Sierra was sufficient. So those were sufficient findings. This case is clearly distinguishable from Sanders. In Sanders, the court reversed, but there all that the district court said was, so on some rough justice basis, it seems to me it is in the interest of justice to add 15 days to the clock. You had a very parse ruling by the district court. You didn't really have any recognition of the operative findings. Here, you don't have that situation. So I suppose that's the easiest path. That gets you to September. In October, the defendants file motions to suppress. Those are pending until the day of trial. But what I was saying is that even if you accept appellant's argument and you say in June that the parties were aware that there was going to be severance, you still don't have 70 days until the filing of the motions to suppress, because other motions are filed within that period. So you only get about, by my count, 53 days between June 7th, 2004 and October 14th, 2004 that are not excluded by the filing of motions. Owens filed two motions during that period, and Abraham filed one. So, and you had hearings. So part of that period is excluded. So even if the court didn't accept the government's argument about the 270-day continuance, the fight between the parties is really only about that period between June 7th and October 14th, 2004. And a more specific answer, I think, to your question, Judge Griffith, about when did Rice join, it's not entirely clear. The court, at pages 401 and 411 of the joint appendix, references the fact that Rice has joined in the...
And remind me, when's the date of that? When did the court...
Well, the one that I'm looking at now, I'm not sure. The page 401 is an earlier hearing, but page 411, the court refers back and says, okay, remember, all the defendants joined.
When did the court say that?
June 27, 2005. And in the interim, you had even more proceedings, which the government really didn't address in detail because we didn't feel it was necessary. But the delays in 2005 were primarily occasioned because co-defendant Bailey, who was tried with appellant, obtained new counsel. His counsel was Jennifer Wicks, who's counsel for appellant on appeal. And there was a delay occasioned by that, not only because there was litigation about whether Ms. Wicks could represent Bailey, but then Ms. Wicks, on Bailey's behalf, filed a series of motions, motions to suppress and other discovery motions, and then those were litigated. And the trial date was twice continued because of that. So So you have all of those different ways to reach the same outcome, which was there was no Speedy Trial Act violation.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. We urge the court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
How much time does Ms. Wicks have left? Oh, okay. Well, we'll be generous and give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, first, in response to a question from Judge Griffith, I think without the 270-day exclusion, there is a Speedy Trial Act violation prior to June 2004. Specifically, there's 44 non-excludable days between January 22nd and March 9th, and then another 43 days between April 1st and May 14th, which, by my math, counts up to 87 days. I think the other, I agree with the court that it was not clear below when Mr. Rice joined in the motion to suppress the wiretaps, but I would note that this was a motion that there was not a hearing necessary. I mean, the court, I think, made the decision in January of 2006, but it was not, there was no evidence presented. The government filed an opposition I believe it's the end of November, the beginning of December of 2004, but that was not a motion that asked for an evidentiary hearing. Clearly, there were several filed on Mr. Bailey's behalf in November and then in March of 2005. But the only continuance from January to May, which was actually the January date was the date first scheduled for local defendants, and the May trial date was the date scheduled for international. And so when Mr. Bailey's prior lawyer, there was a conflict of interest, and for other reasons I became his lawyer, it was continued from January to May. But there were no further continuances based on that issue, and that was clearly another trial date that the court had available. So there's no good reason why the trial didn't start either in May or in June, other than the government wanting to, for whatever reason, thinking that the few days that would be that the court wouldn't be sitting in July would somehow mess up the presentation of evidence in their case, when in fact there was sufficient time between June and August for the trial to occur, given the time that it took to try the case in January and February.
Mr. Smith says this is a case like Lopez Sierra. I understand that you don't agree with that. You don't think it's nearly as complex. But one part of Lopez Sierra seems significant here, which is that there the court said two sentences was sufficient finding to support this ends of justice continuance. Here we have quite substantial discussion the trial court.
I think the difference is the factual basis for the findings in that case. That the factual basis for the findings in that case, I think, would be sufficient for if I was an international defendant from this matter standing before the court. But the evidentiary matters and complexity of that case had to do with a group of solely international defendants. All the evidence was essentially in other countries. There were clearly the language issue, which wasn't relevant to Mr. Rice's case, and complex legal issues pertaining to a wiretap from another country. None of that applies in the case against Mr. Rice and the local defendants. The wiretaps from the other country weren't used. Nothing in a different language was used in Mr. Rice's case. So I think factually is really the difference between this case and that case. And while the court said it succinctly in that case, the factual basis was there. And that's not what is here in Mr. Rice's case. I think for all of the reasons cited, I would ask the court to reverse Mr. Rice's convictions and remand this case for dismissal under the Speedy Trial Act.
Thank you, Ms. Wicks. I know you were appointed by the court to represent the appellant here, and we thank you for your assistance.
You're welcome, Your Honor. Thank you.